Hi.
Hi there.
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine, and we've got Bill Ryan, my partner in Camelot, on the phone.
I'm a few thousand miles away. Can you hear me all right?
Sure. Where are you?
I'm in the middle of Europe, and it's snowing. It's all very Christmassy here. Very different from the way it is there.
Absolutely.
So I would like to say, well, actually, are you pretty much ready to go here?
At this moment, then this is the time that you're supposed to call.
You're a man after our own heart. Thank you for that.
I'll first tell you this, that this particular interview, I mean, I've done a lot of interviews on the radio, and this one, I'm going to open up a lot of other doors that I've not done on any interviews ever, period, with anybody. I think I've only spoken with Walter on and some of my team members about what I'm going to go into today. So it's I kind of decided that this was the time to do this. So,
James, you got us very excited, and we do very much appreciate that. So this is Bill Ryan and Kerry Cassidy from Project Camelot, and the date is Monday, the 30th of November, 2009, and we're talking to James Martinez. And James Martinez is not a name that we immediately recognized when he first contacted us a little over a week ago. But he explained to us that he was the business partner of Walter Bauert, who is a name that many of you listening to this now will recognize as being somewhat of a hero, as the author of the book Operation Mind Control, published back in 1978, and he really did an enormous favor to the whole world, a service to the world, in opening up a really important subject that we have been researching, many others have. And Walter was one of the guys right at the forefront who's made it a lot easier for other people to follow. And James is his business partner, and Walter is no longer with us, alas, otherwise he would be right at the top of our interview list. But we understand that James is able to speak for him in more ways than one. And we are intrigued at the opportunity to talk by proxy to Walter, talking to James now. James, thank you so much for contacting us.
It's no problems. Great to talk with you guys.
What would be wonderful now is if you could introduce yourself, because I just gave it a little soundbite there saying that you are his business partner, but that sounds rather kind of one-dimensional. It sounds to me like it must have been a much more rich relationship than just that.
You're precisely right. This was, I met Walter Bauert because at that particular stage in my life, I'd been very much involved with Hollywood on a media level, especially with things that were, you know, considered unusual. This is way before where we're at today with dealings with UFOs and things of that nature. And I actually met him in Tucson, Arizona. At that time, I was in touch with Doris Van Tassel, which was George Van Tassel's wife, the guy that built the Integraton landers near the Palm Springs area. And I was in touch with Wendell Stevens, and I was in touch with a lot of people. You know, I was very young at this time. I was talking to Colonel Thomas Bearden quite a bit, and a lot of people behind the scenes, some military people.
What year was this?
Actually, I would say about 10 years ago. And I remember the day that I met him at his apartment in Tucson, and I was very, very, very impressed with his level of knowledge and understanding of not only the human condition, but the capabilities of the human condition as well. We both had a very strong tie because we were both adopted. That was a big theme that shaped his life to the very, very end, actually. And it was that premise, and he was very interested in me immediately, and I was in touch with him right away. And I found out he wrote this book, Operation Mind Control, and I was immediately fascinated with the book itself.
Could you say a little bit about the book, James, for the benefit of our listeners who may not have read it or may not even have encountered it? Can you give a summary of how important that book was?
Yeah, it was. I'm going to say what it is and what it really has become, according to Walter. So what it was, and because I'm going to state it here for the record, and this may be a surprise to many people, but what it was is it was the template in Meme that was the first really authoritative investigation of the application of mind control, that term, that meme that he set up, on a civilian with the intention of getting that civilian to be able to kill without knowing that they did it and have and can continue their life. In other words, you know, have multiple identities in very incongruent timelines where the conscious self is unaware of the act and has gone into a state of dissociation, which was a huge issue for Walter himself in terms of what has happened to humanity. The idea and concept of inducing by suggestion or otherwise, drugs or whatever it is, heart conditioning, into the spirit of a human being, it violates the soul, it violates other laws that I'm sure that are spiritually sound in any text, and he and I had a big issue with that, just in general. So he and I were like brothers. I lived with him at one time in Santa Monica when he first came to California. I spent a lot of time with him. I met his family. I met his billionaire wife at that time that he married in New York City, Peggy Hitchcock. So the Operation Mind Control was the template for all media around it afterwards, because it became a tool and it opened up a lot of doors and thinking patterns that were occurring during that time. And I'll tell you, he regretted writing that book after what he learned later on in his life.
He regretted writing the book?
Yeah, very much so. It really hindered his life, very much so.
Was that because, as a very multidimensional person, he became defined by that one book? Or was it because there were consequences of his writing the book?
Both. I mean, it began his career and ended his career immediately. He had all sorts of problems when it initially came out, when he went on his first book tour, which he told me in depth and details how well-received the book was, because he was already respected, and a lot of people may not know this, he really was respected in the 60s, because he was a key player in the 60s when Leary and the whole drug movement began, the LSD movement, the entire 60s, he was very much involved with when he was the editor-in-chief of the East Village Other in New York City. And during that time in New York City, that was extremely influential time. He met everybody that was everybody. He was in charge of the exorcism that they did on the Pentagon. He also testified before Congress regarding the use of LSD, which really at that point put him on the map globally because of what he said. Because his primary interest was to advance consciousness, because he knew that what he discovered, though it was limited at that time, I mean, if I were to talk to him here in the moment, he had a limited understanding, and he regretted the delivery of the book because it was bought out immediately and it became a bestseller, and it's a collector's item to this day because it was bought out and they didn't want that on the street. But he came to later regret the fact that when he wrote that book, it reinforced and suggested to a lot of unbeknownst people that this technology is available and works and is continuing to work on a certain level. So he knew, as well as I know, after spending like a long time with him, that there are other issues in the thinking process of a human being that were not really considered in his expose, and that was most of the work of Marshall McLuhan, which is to this day not being discussed in the financial world. I'm the only one on radio that is talking about what the digital environment does to the brain and what it does to accounting. And the reason I am here doing this today is because he wanted to do Operation Mind Control Phase 2, which is what I am involved with right now. It's kind of the irony of him not being here during this critical time for everybody. I understand now that he's better off and more efficient on the other side, so to speak, than he would be in present, because he, as he got older, he was suffering from colon cancer and had gone through an enormous amount of cancer treatment that was not helping him, and he knew it, and he knew that he was about to leave just before, I would say, this transformation is taking place on the entire planet.
Well, thank you, James. I wanted to ask you specifically, wouldn't you say that he brought to the public the whole story of MKUltra? Is that correct?
Yes, he was the delivery of it. Yes.
Okay, because you haven't actually referred to it as MKUltra.
Right. Reason why is because I understand for people that are highly sensitive, the use of language and the delivery for this type of subject matter can trigger people. And I don't want to, because I know this is heard quite a bit, that my words may be repeated and relooped and relooped in a continuous session. And for me to reinforce a word like that can reconfirm to the in the central nervous system of an individual that may have been traumatized and subject to this, it reaffirms that they're unwilling to change.
Okay, I have another question.
Sure.
What I wanted to do is find out a little bit about Walter's background, such that he got himself in a position where he felt he was knowledgeable enough at that point to write such a book. Could you tell the audience what his background was?
Well, he was primarily a writer. He graduated from Oklahoma as a writer. He moved to New York City and wanted to become a writer. And it was during that time in the 60s where he began the East Village Other, which was a tremendously influential. He began the alternative news. He started it through that meme of the East Village Other. And it was during that time that he was receiving calls from military guys that he was trying to be able to assist, because he was dealing with military people that were calling him up, telling him, you know, what they had been through, and the fact that some of the ideas that he suggested in news items and conversations with people, there was some truth to it, that some people did lose their memories in special wars. They were trauma victims, and there was something much more sinister going on behind the scenes. And they came to him. He didn't decide, okay, I'm going to write this book. It was a series of events that he kind of magnetically attracted these people into his experience. A lot of military people and people that were very high profile in terms of money during that time in the 60s. He and I coined the term the disease of richcraft, as the people that are financing these operations and had the psychology to be so disassociated themselves they couldn't even see humanity. I mean, they had reduced a human being into like some work animal for warmongers. I mean, he was very sensitive to this issue. So these people were coming to him, and then when he committed and decided to investigate this further, I think he was in touch with Condon at that time, who did the Manchurian Candidate. He decided, okay, I need to find out what's going on with this. And he was well trusted because of the East Village Other. He had a lot of sources with military people at that time that were going, the whole 60s movement and the altered time in which consciousness was changing because of the use of LSD. He was interested in that meme. That's really what was the most influential part of his life, was the 60s revolution and the use of LSD into the culture. I mean, he confessed to me, because when he was at the East Village Other and the Operation Mind Control was like, was starting to form and his studies and whatnot, that he was considering with some people involved with that newspaper that they were going to manufacture a large volume of LSD and pour it into the city of Washington, D.C.
Are you saying Walter himself, or are you saying that the people...
Walter himself And people that own the East Village Other in New York City, and some of these people included the guy that discovered LSD. I forgot his name, slips my mind at the moment. But he was involved with the people that had put together this. He referred to it as an unknown molecule that changes the consciousness of an individual forever. And here's another thing that most people do not know about him. And this is that during this time when he was doing Operation Mind Control and he was involved in East Village Other, there was an assassination attempt on him. Three people, actually, that he was with. He's the one who did not die, but they, at that time, he said and told me multiple times that someone had tried to kill him and test a new drug, something that had been manufactured in a lab. So what happened is two people that were associates of his died within 48 hours, and he was high on acid for 40 days, or something happened for 40 days in New York City during a period of his life where that was more influential than anything that he had ever, because at that time he told me he made contact with advanced species. He had a 40-day nonstop experience, which he talked quite a bit about to me in private, which deeply affected his life and his idea of even putting out Operation Mind Control. So he's a very conflicted guy, because he knew when he put out this book, it could potentially be more damaging than healing, because his thing was to liberate the human spirit, as is mine. We both shared that need to do that on a very deep level.
Okay, so that's very interesting. I have to say that it sounds as though he must have also had in his background, perhaps, some issues with potentially having been mind-controlled himself. Did he ever broach that subject?
Yeah, he did, because he knew, he's a very unusual guy, because we had long discussions about his personal projection into the universe and his identity, and yeah, so he did have issues like that. He actually did, because we talked about it a lot, because I was friends with him, so I heard all the baggage, you know, as well as the good stuff. So I got a total overview of his entire personality, and he was very much, you know, in the later part of his life, very much wanted to be involved in healing.
I hear that. I definitely hear that side of it. Well, now that I know what you're talking about in terms of his background, I'm just curious, because if he created this, it's in essence, it was a newspaper called the East Village Other, right?
Mm-hmm.
And obviously it was sort of a counterculture newspaper of its time, and you're saying it actually started, from what you said, in a way it was one of the first of its kind.
That's right. That's right.
Okay. So in essence, what he kind of became a magnet for the release of information, being an alternative newspaper. Was he the editor?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
And so that these people came to him almost as whistleblowers come to us at this day.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
Which, you know, because there's interesting parallels going on there. And so they must have told him their stories. And is this what became, in essence, the book?
Yes, that's right. I always joked with him. I said, did you get another confessional this week? Because he would become a source for people to come to confess.
Yeah, very interesting.
Or like, you're carrying on part of it. You guys are doing it.
Yes, absolutely.
You're doing it.
Yeah,
part of it.
So, in essence, he was a member of the original counterculture, and the person you're saying is Dr. Albert Hofmann, who mm-hmm. created discovered LSD. And so he was as much involved in it as he was a reporter of it. That period
very
of time
so.
That, you know, in other words, what MKUltra was also involved with was using LSD to break down the mental barriers,
mm-hmm.
and so on. In other words, he kind of stumbled into a snake pit in a way at that time.
That's right. That's right. Big snake pit.
Yeah, that's amazing. Okay, so he was really, really on the cutting edge at that
time. I'm interested to hear just a little bit more on his later thoughts that led him to feel that maybe he regretted writing the book, because for many, it was an eye-opener. Certainly for myself, it was one of the stepping stones that has helped me do the work that I'm doing today with Kerry, for sure. And I know that I'm not alone in that view. I owe him a huge debt of gratitude, and I think he's a hero. And while he was still alive, he must have got a lot of positive feedback. And it would be very interesting if you could relay the positive feedback he got and any negative information that he took on board that led him to believe that he might have done the wrong thing. I'm just really interested in that.
Yeah, it's weird because he part of him was very proud that he did that because it put him on the map, and he gained a lot of trust. He emanated that if you told him something in confidence, he would not only understand you, but he would bond with you in that understanding. He was brilliant at it, actually. He had some shamanistic tendencies, for sure, in terms of you could trust him. But towards the end of his life, he much would have preferred to write fiction because of all the trouble that had started in his personal life. His personal life was like a disaster area. And I don't mind saying that because he was married 3 or 4 times. He had unsuccessful marriages. Each time he was married to Peggy Hitchcock, which was set up by Dr. Tim Leary back in the 60s, which is what he thought, even though his free will was not inhibited, because of who he was in New York City, in the East Village other, he was introduced to billionaire Peggy Hitchcock, which was tied into the Mellon dynasty, Mellon banking dynasty, which in itself is where I came out of. Because both of us had problems with the disease of witchcraft, like I mentioned earlier. So he essentially, towards the end of his life, felt like he didn't get to have a life of his own, and he missed a lot of healing himself because of the his actions from the East Village Other and writing the Operation Mind Control really interfered with his life, because he was interfered with by government many, many, many times. And there's some more personal stuff I know about his relationship with his family that I'll leave private. But his personal relationship with his family was destroyed. And so he never really made a bond and had a home. And I know a lot of people may not understand that, because an adoptee would understand that. And he had major problems with his adoption and finding a home. And he never really did find a home. So he acted like a foot soldier for a lot of people and never really had any satisfaction and kind of the love that he deserved and wouldn't allow himself. That is what he regretted that book doing, because he never got that. And for many people at the end of the road, when they reach the end of their life, those are the things that they're going to hold in their memory, not the car that they got or the house that they got or whatever, whatever. So regretted that book.
Okay, that's fascinating. You said that Timothy Leary introduced him to Peggy Hitchcock. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
And apparently Timothy Leary was also working for the CIA. Mm-hmm. And therefore, it actually sounds as though perhaps they engineered the marriage at some level.
Oh, it was engineered. It was definitely engineered and put before him. And he knows he made the wrong decision. He told me later on. He had a weird way of talking about his choices and the fact that he was well aware that he created the reality he did and da-da-da-da-da and all that stuff. But he made some big mistakes during that time. And one of them was he was concerned about a child that he already had and the health of that child and being able to financially support that child. And it was because of that that he married Peggy Hitchcock. There never was any real fulfilling relationship there. And that, of course, during that time, that the marriage to Peggy Hitchcock, okay, this is where it gets really interesting, is the level and class and consciousness of individuals on that level, that playing field of money, is a level that most people have no concept and no understanding of how those people think and how they are so cut off and so disassociated and so removed from society that they can conceive and do things that they do on an international level, because that was the key point that really put him in a state of where he wanted to find out more of how the really rich think. And it's way different than people would care to believe or want to believe. And he told me, both of us knew way early, like 10 years ago, that the whole economy was going to collapse and there was going to be dramatic shifts and they're going to, you know, the new technologies were going to come out and they've been hidden from the hook. This is, we talked about this all the time, and we're well aware of the money situation and the whole manipulation of money and so forth. And he and I, that's where we really bonded, is the money issue. Because, you know, all this stuff that's going on is for profit. It's for greed. It's materialistic consciousness that's stuck somewhere because a group of people cannot get a grip on themselves because they're so removed from the world, so disconnected, that they do not have any humanity at all. That is the disease in itself, and that was the key thing that bonded both of us together. And he, since he was dying at that point, and his health was failing him when he lived in Santa Monica, he said, listen, I have to correct what I have done with this book. I have to correct it. I have to leave you in charge of my legacy, because I know you will probably be the only one that speaks publicly about me ever, because you knew me in the last phase. So I want to make sure that you be able to talk about this particular work, say what happened to me, say to the people that are listening, that have paid attention to this, that it's time to stop focusing on all the bad crap that you can do with mind control and start focusing on some of the healing things. He was well aware of that, and that was the main emphasis on the final part of his life, was to alter this. If you focus on the bad stuff, that's what you're going to get. And if people want to keep focusing on MKUltra and all the bad things that accrue with it, it will reinforce those people that not only are triggered and all coded into that already, but it will suggest to people and put them in a somnambulistic technological state, which will put them there in the first place. I mean, one of the things that I wanted to go back and answer this for you is he failed to put in his book Operation Mind Control, and he regretted this later on, was the works and the influence of Marshall McLuhan and what he had to say about media and its effect on consciousness. That played a huge, massive part in his re-understanding the much larger picture that is going on, that all of us are dealing with right now, as even all three of us are embedded in the digital environment now. He knew, and he explained to me, because he did come out with an updated version of Operation Mind Control that was like a collector's edition that had many upgrades that he had discovered and learned about later on in his life, which was not included in the first book. It really kind of turned a couple of things around when he started to talk about Marshall McLuhan and the effects of media and consciousness and so forth, and how that plays a part in the conditioning of populations and what it does to the brain, the computer being the extension of the nervous system, and the extension of the nervous system put out into the field like it has now is changed forever. How human beings think. And he integrated that into the book Operation Mind Control in a later edition. There's some of those copies are around. I have one of them. I know a lot of other people bought those, but that it was included on top of it. So he did kind of, in a certain sense, correct what he left out in the book, in the original. So he did leave that behind for me to say that that exists, and that you cannot talk about MKUltra if you're not including the model that Marshall McLuhan brought to the world, which indicates that man's media extensions, such as television, things of that nature, and how it affects the thinking process. And if there's anything that he would want to make sure that I say that was put out there for everybody, is if you're not including those things in your model of your reality and how consciousness functions and how we process information through those media environments, then you're not up to date at all. You're behind. And that is probably, if there, for all those students out there of this that have taken up lots of time studying his work and all the stuff that's on the web about it, I would tell you that he would say, if you're taking any of that seriously, you have to look at this other model of what how consciousness is affected by the technology and man's extensions. That is the key thing he would have brought up at the very end here, because he knew that that book, it was used in all sorts of, I mean, conspiracy theory, Mel Gibson, the Bourne Supremacy franchise was based on the Walter Bohr's work, that Long Kiss Goodnight with Samuel Jackson was based upon his work. He really coined that term, and he saw it, and he was called by HBO, all sorts of movies people scanned in. And I'll tell you another thing that I've not ever said publicly is that he and I went into a private meeting with Oliver Stone in Santa Monica with Walter Bohr, and at that point he had written other fiction books and other nonfiction books, and he wanted to leave Oliver Stone with the rights to do with whatever he wanted to with Operation Mind Control. That never happened, because in our meeting with Oliver Stone, he was just, he's not there. He's got deep PTSD and all sorts of other problems and things that we recognized and spoke about in the room while Oliver was there. And I remember Walter getting up on his feet and slapping his hands together really loud, and he goes, "Listen, Oliver, right over here, right over here." He goes, "Quiet," and started kind of bossing him around a little bit in the room when I was there. And I was like, "What the hell are you?" Like, I was like so shocked that he was doing that with Oliver Stone in the room, because we took like 16 phone calls to make this thing happen. And we finally got in the room, and then Walter Bohr just said, "I don't want to work with this guy at all. He doesn't get it. He's not even in the room. How can he possibly understand the larger amplifications of making a movie which you'd be putting out into the digital environment that would maybe trigger people? It has to be done in a completely different way." He and I, at the end of his life, what we wanted to do was take this old meme that was out there, Operation Mind Control, and install a new one so that we could use media as a vehicle to liberate the human condition of what it is now, because it's in such a catastrophic, bizarre, transformative state right now that we're so desensitized to violence, we're so desensitized to anything. We turn on the TV, 30 seconds later, you know, to switch channels, you can see murder, death, kill, rape, everything, you know, every atrocity you could imagine. There's an accident before us in those cities. Most people don't even assist in helping people. So we were constructing and put together a company called Soma Corporation, which was Semiotic Off-Screen Media Arts. Soma Corporation, it was set up in California. It was going to be the first company in the history of history that was going to go to media outlets and talk with the producers, talk with the directors, and use media to heal instead of hurt the public. That's where his main emphasis is at the very end, because he realized that the meme of MKUltra and mind control itself was actually putting people under those conditions in the first place by the mere suggestion of it. So especially because I don't think people understand that the technological environment has subnambulistic tendencies to it. And people forget that technological somnambulism puts people into a hypnotic state in the first place. And the use of film and television and the computers, we're literally mapping the brain now with computers. I mean, the dissociative states that I see in Los Angeles when people are using cell phones, the discontinuity that the digital environment creates, all those things were in the second phase of Operation Mind Control. And what the whole reason I came to do this interview, as well as continue on with his work in a certain manner having to do with finances, was to introduce this so people would understand that, you know, this is what's happening to the evolution of humans right now. This is, banking has been destroyed by the digital environment, and the combination thereof, if people have a larger understanding of their media environments and the capabilities of what human beings can actually do versus what we think we can do and what we've been suggested by media, that we're not good enough, we have no self-esteem, and so forth, we could take care of a lot of these problems.
This is actually, I mean, what you're talking about is absolutely wonderful in terms of what you're conveying, that you and Walter had an understanding that was really a step back from the individual or even group mind control, but to the techniques used by actually digital media, as you call it, and media across the spectrum. But I was wondering if he was also in touch with the occult significance. There is an occult significance to all of this, and there are practices in which the media is used for occult means and ends. And that's why, in essence, the media is used in a negative direction, because of the occult overlay. And I'm wondering if he tapped into that, if he was conscious of that, and the role it was playing.
Oh, very conscious of it. Very conscious of it. I hadn't even gone to the dirtiest of dirty in terms of what he was told about the abuse of children, the pedophile rings, the taping of sexual acts, the manipulation of how children are sexualized when they're very young, and there's generational incest involved with a compartmentalization and disassociative process of children in rings all over the world.
You were talking, in essence, about the Illuminati, and you're talking about the rich being the Illuminati and being inculcated with this program, which is a negative programming that involves, is basically Satanism, in which they are using children as sacrifices, they're using sex to manipulate, and they're using it in the group way through the media and through things like television and film and so on, and advertising, et cetera, et cetera. But it's all to the end of feeding the beast, so to speak.
That's right. It's the that is the disease of witchcraft. It has a sexual nature to it. It has the incestuous nature of people at the highest level of power that are cut off and have no problem destroying a whole ring of children all over the world. There is so much unbelievable, I don't even know what to call it. It's so beyond mentally ill that I don't even want to talk about it. It's so bad that the stuff he knew about that was going on with children and all these missing children that have happened all over the place. I mean, I would suggest that some of it, yes, probably is UFO related, and the other stuff is these children are recruited, sexualized, and used and disposed of when it's over with. There's murder going on as well. The conditioning process to take one of these individuals from a very young age and install a bunch of programs that can be used for later use, which is essentially, what can happen if you know the correct tools in which to disassociate a child, whether through sex abuse or sensory deprivation or breaking the shamans refer to as breaking the soul, splitting the soul of an entity, a child, when it's young, and fragmenting it and putting it into a dissociative state, which is the MPD term that has been coined, multiple personality disorder. That Walter Bohr did not like that name at all, and he knew it should have been it was upgraded to dissociative identity disorder, which is the dissociated states of individuals which have been traumatized. And it's the people at the various highest top that are manipulating and doing these things that have all the money, they're disassociated themselves because they've been victims of it.
Right.
So it's a generational thing that's been going on for a long, long time. And there are, if people want to call it cult, Satanistic, whatever, they may go ahead. But is it going on? Can I confirm that? Yes. Did we talk about it? Yes. Was he concerned about it? Completely. Completely concerned about it. Because it doesn't end. That stuff is, it's very difficult to treat those type of people that have been damaged like that. And most of the time, if they continue on in their evolution, they will marry and they will do it themselves, or they will attract somebody to have it continue in the lineage of that family.
In, I think it was chapter 9 of the book that I believe is called The Story of O, and O is just an initial for one of the witnesses. Was that Kathy O'Brien before she and Mark Phillips wrote the book, The Transformation of America?
I know what chapter you're referring to. He had been in touch with them, but he never said that O was anybody. He would never reveal the source, especially even to me in some remote location because of these people. He felt like if they confessed to him, it was the host of the personality that had this problem that had come to him, meaning the original entity before it was fractured. He knows deep down that they can't trust anybody. So when people would tell him things in confidence regarding subject matter like this, he maintained those agreements with them. So he never released the name of this particular thing, but it suggests in here that that is what he was referring to.
That's very interesting, James, because it implies that he was always mindful of his responsibility to try and heal his contacts.
Yeah, that's precisely where he was at. And this is another thing that people should know as well, is that he had his own problems because of his own identity, himself. So he was healing himself by doing this for others in later stages of his life. That's precisely where he's at.
I understand. Now, I have a bunch of questions to ask you about his later work, but I'm very aware that you want to use this opportunity to state on Walter's behalf anything that he feels would like to be in the public domain and associated with his book for the benefits of any readers who don't know the full story. Is there anything else that you'd like to explain on his behalf about how he felt, what he admitted, what he would have liked to have added, his thoughts and feelings about the entire thing before we move on?
Well, He was regretful that he did it because he felt it was more damaging in the initial stages. He definitely wanted to fix that, and he and I were collaborating at the later stages of his life to do that, and he put that corporation together, Soma Corporation. Semiotic Off-Screen Media Arts was the name of it, and that was going to be the vehicle. He was going to use the meme of MKUltra and Operation Mind Control to get through the doors of different media outlets and film and TV and use the mediums such as television and film as a tool to heal people. I think he did not get to see that manifestation totally. I mean, I've carried on an essential part of it, but I think that after I met him, I met with him, I remember the last couple of times before I saw him, before he died, he just was very thin and was suffering quite a bit, and he was ready to go. He told me, it's just you have to make sure that people need to understand the ramifications of the digital environment and to include that in their conclusions of these type of operations that are, I think, are still happening. Because a lot of people think that you have to have the military or somebody else to be able to create a personality like this that can do these things. And that's not true. This type of abuse happens all the time, and you can form different things out of a personality that you go through these abusive cases. These are just very sophisticated ways of traumatizing people and defiling their spirit. And he told me, and I will tell this for you, and you can put this on a tape or not. It doesn't matter. But I did contact the gentleman that you just mentioned,
Duncan O'Finian.
I did watch your interview with him, and I looked real closely, and I did contact him, and I told him, you know, that I used to work for Walter Brewer and was a close friend of his, and he responded back, and then I told him that I suggested to him that he go and see Colin Ross, because Colin Ross was one of the doctors that Walter Brewer dealt with quite a bit in Texas, and he's the current expert, supposedly, in the field of dissociative identity disorder. And since I saw that video footage and I looked real close, including his own website, I didn't really get into some of the other things that Walter Brewer would have suggested that people that have been through this type of trauma would do. And one of the things he would suggest, and I'm suggesting it here because he would have backed me up 110% with this, is the use of ayahuasca, which David Icke has mentioned in his book and is quite common all over the web now. That healing agent would be a tool that Walter Brewer would endorse for individuals that have gone through this type of trauma.
Well, that's a very, I have to say, a controversial statement. But I can appreciate that I think there's a lot of investigations being done in that area at this time. I wanted to ask you on another note about his ET experiences, because you did mention that he had that, and it would be interesting to find out when that started happening with him and whether or not he attributed any of that to any kind of, say, mind control or overlay, you know, attempt to put an overlay or a false memory into him, or whether he felt he had actual contact and so on.
Oh, he made contact. He talked to me privately about it multiple times. It happened during the 42-day acid trip that the government used some. He told me that the government dropped him something that put him out for 42 days, and during that time, he did make contact, and he was very, very, very much into the UFO issue, though he was not very public about it at all. He didn't like the way it was presented at all. He was invited to a lot of conferences having to do with that, and he just didn't want to be involved with it, though he spoke with me at length about what happened to him and what he saw and what he experienced. And he told me, this was, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago, while he's very ill, he told me about his contact that he had in New York, and that he had met these beings, pure light beings, that essentially walked him around. They didn't say anything. There was no language. They walked him around, and he was had telepathic communication, and he experienced special healing abilities during that time. He said he tri-projected. So he was in multiple places at the same time. There were calls coming in saying that he was in Paris and New York and L.A. all at the same time. He had a major experience that he always would talk to me in private at some point when we would discuss matters, because he thought very much so that was another part of Operation Mind Control, that he was very conflicted of whether or not he wanted to put the UFO scenario tied into this or not. But he said later on to me privately, how could it not? It's all tied in together. It's all tied in to the spirit of the planet. It's like human beings have amnesia. They can't remember, or they're in a state of post-traumatic stress disorder already and don't want to know where they've come from. So he told me during one of his memories of the experience, he said that the beings told him that everything is perfect, and he agreed with them. He goes, you're right, everything is perfect. And then I asked Walter, what do you mean everything's perfect? It's a disaster area. He goes, no, it's not. It's exactly what people created. It's exactly what people created. Human beings are in a deep state of amnesia. They don't want to acknowledge their greater abilities and their connections to their relatives. He thought the biggest problem with the human race, according to his contact, was that the lack of self-esteem that it has. It doesn't believe in itself.
Yeah, that's excellent information, and in our view, quite right. What about MILABS, military abductions? Did he have any experiences himself along those lines? Was he aware of that phenomena?
Yeah,
going
he was very much aware of it. He thought a lot of it was faked for political purposes. He's following it pretty closely, the UFO field. I remember when I was living with him in Santa Monica, he did again, some more anonymous people came to him, and he interviewed some people having to do with their cases, and he was fascinated by it, but at the same time, it was like hard to believe, because he had a lady that he interviewed that all she wanted to talk about is sex with aliens. That was like the main topic of conversation. But he had all sorts of unusual cases of people recovering memories of meeting beings and bad experiences and good experiences. He was secretly investigating that matter all the time. He was very much interested in my relationship with Doris Van Tassel, George Van Tassel's wife. For those that don't know out there, the Integratron time machine that was inspired by his contacts out in Landers, and out near Joshua Tree. He was always asking me what Doris Van Tassel was talking about in terms of her contacts with these advanced species. And it was his communications and that experience shaped him more than anything, I would say, because he was very, very quiet about that and still knew there was a stigma attached to even discussing those matters. But when everything was quiet and nobody was around, he told me about these experiences that took place in New York where he met these advanced species, and he said they were just pure light. He could see figures of them. They had bodies, but they were full light. And that the main message that he acknowledged from that is that we are the creators. We actually create the we're the gods in amnesia, so to speak. And that was the main thing which he understood, is that on some levels he would tell me that if he would sit down with a survivor of one of these projects that actually found him and would want to reveal themselves face to face to him and have a conversation, a lot of the things that in terms of the therapeutic models which he used, which everything from NLP to hypnosis to, if necessary, shamanistic tools to get this person to integrate the personalities together, because he was very aware of how the DID model works in terms of the host of the original entity being violated and it splitting apart into various mechanisms that would be like frontal projection. So there would be a concierge, or the host, he would call, of these individuals. And then many of the cases which he dealt with that people came to him had UFO-related stuff going on. So not only were they abused, but they had UFO-related experience as well. So that was a major portion of his life that he never really got to talk about publicly, and I don't think he ever would have, his UFO experiences. But I know, so, for the record, that that was one of the chief proponents that affected his life.
But he must have had volumes of tapes and notes and things. Did he give those over to you? Have you been able to, I don't know, correlate those or listen to them?
I have. My last interview I did with him and somebody else, when he passed away, the Ex-Wives Club decided they were going to take action, because I know that he was going to release his final book, which is going to be called The War of This World. That was the final book that he wanted to release. He didn't give me any of the contents of it. It was only to be released after he passed away. I do not know where the disc is. All I know is that most of his property, in terms of his writing and stuff that was on his computers, is in California, and nothing is being done with it at this time. His family will not speak to me, at least not voluntarily, because of what I know that he told me about what occurred, the damaging effects of the book itself, Operation Mind Control. That was a big problem for the family. I mean, it really ruined his life. Though he would say to me, look, I know I created the situation. I know I did it. So I had a disastrous relationships with my family and my marriages because of unveiling this. So he really paid a dear price, because he never got to accepted in terms of having a normal relationship the interference.
I have to say, this isn't clear. I don't understand the link-up that you're making between his family relationship and the book he wrote. In other words,
okay.
I haven't read the book, so I don't know, but did he talk about his personal life in the book?
No. What happened is, after the book came out, some of the intelligence agencies, according to him, affected his family, and I'll just leave it at that.
Well, actually, why are you leaving it at that? Because, I mean, we don't need to delve into the specifics of the family ins and outs of relationships and so on. But, in other words, are we talking about the efforts of the powers that be to do mind control upon his family as a result of him writing that book?
To damage his family, to give him a message to back off.
James is saying that he was punished, Kerry. I think that's all we need to know.
That's it. There you go.
I'd like to ask a very quick question just about the book. Did he leave any instructions in his will, or is that not something that you are party to and can't comment on at all?
I don't even think he had a will. He gave everything he had away in the later years of his life, and he was very much in love with a Russian doctor who he lived with until the last breath. He met her at HMI, which is the Hypnosis Motivation Institute in California, where he graduated with honors as a master hypnotist. He really didn't care about anything. He felt in the last 3 years of his life that he really didn't get to live a life that most people had in terms of quality.
But you're saying that he left behind what was in essence a book, another book to be released, and a body of work. And
yep.
He may have given away everything, but surely he didn't give that away. And so are you saying
I don't even know where that material is. I think I have an idea of where it is, but whether or not it'll ever be released or not, I don't know, because that's a property issue now. And they're going to have to read it and then decide if they want to profit off of it, and it gets into a whole publishing issue, and do they want to bring that upon themselves again? You know, the family, whoever does it. I mean, there's a bunch of issues that whoever gets that property, whether it's his daughter or his son or his ex-wife or whoever has it, it could potentially cause problems for them. So I don't know what's going to become of those. I mean, I've tried to access that stuff myself, but I was kind of left out of it. They don't want to talk to me because I know too much about the situation. So they don't want to even want to see me again, the rest of the family, because I am aware of all the stuff that has occurred within the family dynamic. So I'm kind of letting it go and letting if the property or any of that stuff is in my immediate ability to access it, I will do what's right about it. But at this time, nothing regarding his properties, I don't think, is going to be coming out in any time soon. The War of This World was the final book that he wanted to put out, but he wanted to put it out after he had left.
Uh-huh. But you're saying he wanted you to carry on his legacy, yet he didn't give you his last book.
No, he wanted me to carry on the legacy of exposing the money system and what is the type of personalities that are running the money system. That's really what he wanted me to do, because if you unravel the money system and follow the money, there will be the answers to many of the problems that exist there. Because he knew what the international bankers were doing and how all this was financed and the whole thing. He was well aware of it. However, he told me, you know, if you do this, you can attract possibly some of the negative effects that I've had to deal with. So, you know, he left the decision up to me, though he knew I was going to take what he had taught me and go head to head in the media with exposing the banks, which is what I've done. And I've explained how I've done that on the radio and why I did it on the radio. And because basically I told him before I was going to die that I was going to put my 2 cents in too, and say, listen, I learned all the stuff that he taught me and he exposed me to about behavior modification and what you can do. And what I discovered is, and I showed him, I said, listen, do you know what the credit card companies are doing? He wasn't paying attention to everything. And I said, listen, look at their media archetypes, look at what they're doing, look at the contracts, look at everything and how what they're doing to manipulate everybody. And he was fascinated that I showed this to him, and I said, I'm going to handle this myself. And basically, he decided, so what you want to do is you want to take people that have massive financial problems and reconstruct their lives. In other words, by getting them out of these alleged debts and liberating them and using NLP and hypnosis and all sorts of other techniques to liberate people. That's what he and I were working on at the very end. His final book, I know what it was about. It was about some of the larger issues that you guys talk about here with the extraterrestrial issues, time travel, all those things. That's what was in it, the fight for who's going to be running the show here. And all of you, both you two, are right in the middle of it.
Right. And this is actually very interesting. So you're telling me that he was not only aware of what was going on with the Illuminati, in other words, what we call the controllers, but he was aware of the people, the ET influences, and maybe ultra-dimensionals, whatever you want to call. He was aware of that aspect of it.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. He just didn't, he wasn't very public about it, but he was well aware of it. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like he had the big picture, I must say.
He would confess, he'd tell you, well, I may have the big picture, but I'm not happier.
So, oh, boy, yeah, I know.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, just to clear up a question of my own, James, in about 1990, I was handed a photocopied, typewritten synopsis of a book that Walter was planning on writing with Richard Sutton called The Invisible Third World War. I'm looking at it right now, nonfiction, approximately 100,000 words. It's on the internet. I typed it out. I put it out there. I think some other people put it out there as well, this synopsis. Is this the same unpublished book that you've been referring to with a different title? Or do you know what happened to that one that I'm talking about?
That's probably the beginning of it. That's
right.
Probably the beginning of it. That's, you probably have one of its stages. Because in the last 3 or 4 years, he was, I mean, if he wasn't in bed sick or going to chemotherapy, he was typing on the computer, writing.
Right, because this synopsis was something that was written around about 1990 or possibly in the late 1980s. It was something that he worked on way back then. It's very well worked. It's got a whole bunch of notes. The last chapter is called Controlling the Soul, Project Scannet, the Toth Incident, something about Tesla, the Eugene wavelength, the Moscow signal, Jonestown, Rocky Mountain plague, Wizards of Death. I'm just looking at the chapter headings here. It looked like a wonderful book, and I spent half of the last 19 years waiting for this book to be published, and I never realized that it might never be published. It's one of these things that was like a teaser. But it's not the big picture in the way that you've described it. There's no connection to the financial game, to nasty pedophilic politics, which is what we talked about earlier very briefly. Nothing about time travel and the ETs. It's mainly about electromagnetic warfare.
Mm-hmm. He was real private about that, but I know he was going to put it in. He couldn't deny it.
Right. I got it. Yeah. Okay. I'll send what I have to you, and I would be very interested in your comments on that. I presume you've seen it.
Saw various. I mean, he had so much paperwork lying around. If you walk into his office, there was so much paperwork everywhere. It was like a overflow of documents, books, typing, computer disks, everything. He was constantly in the last 5 years manufacturing something, and I wasn't interfering with it a lot, but I know what was going on. His girlfriend, who lived with him the last 3 years, is well aware of what he was doing, and she doesn't have these properties either, because his family, after he passed away, came to the house and took all his stuff, basically, and then they took it up to Northern California, and that's where it rests. Somewhere it's on some disk somewhere. I may be able to get access to it. I may not. I don't know. But if I do, I'll let you know for sure.
Oh boy.
Absolutely. I actually am looking at something on the internet, which apparently is an excerpt of his book. And it's got, I guess, I'm not sure if they're chapter headings or what, but this is the Operation Mind Control book. And one of those titles is called Sleeper Agent. And I'm just going to read this briefly because I want you to address this. And I think these are Walter Boert's actual words. He says, Joe called me one day from Australia. I was still working on Grub Street as the editor of Palm Springs Life. He told me what most of the victims of mind control have told me. I read your book, and this is a quote he put, I read your book, you saved my sanity. I now know I'm not crazy. Thanks so much for writing it, unquote. That was reward enough for doing it, I suppose, but I didn't want to do it again. I wanted nothing more to do with mind control. I was burned out on the subject. so Joe got a polite but disinterested reception from me. He kept up a correspondence with me anyway from the outback. At first, his letters were fragmented, disjointed. Mine were polite, encouraging, brief. I couldn't tell where he was coming from, but what do you expect from a victim whose mind had been scrambled? He began by talking about some missing British scientists. I mean, that is a really riveting paragraph. And can you comment on that at all? In other words, we're talking about a sleeper agent. So obviously he was in touch with something that is actually a very strong interest of mine, which is sleeper agents that are positioned around our society and in the world at this time to be activated at a later date. And he's also talking about missing scientists. And of course, we know about the death of microbiologists and so on and so forth. So there's a huge area that hasn't been really tapped into in this area that we're talking about here.
Yeah. He mentioned to me about these type of programmables that he would call them sometime. And he knew that they'd have their regular lives. Somebody would make a phone call, leave a sentence on the machine, an acoustic recording that was live, and then they'd be activated and they'd go do their job. And he knew the capabilities were there, but he had mentioned to me that there was his book, A Conspiracy Against Man, he used that as a probable title, is that everybody that was trying to help out in science, that were trying to evolve the human condition to a better place, were getting killed. He told me, he was like, there's a group of people that do not want human beings to evolve. They just don't want it to happen, and they're going to kill off science. They're manipulating science. It's not true. He got into a lot of physics and the biology, and he told me in a conversation, this is when I was driving back from San Francisco with him to Los Angeles, he told me that, they're going to kill off scientific bodies. He says they can control the scientific content of information and manipulate the worlds. Not only a country, but the worlds. And for under normal circumstances, if you were talking to somebody like this, they're not going to even believe that statement. But after spending a lot of time with him, I knew that was a total probable reality that was actually going on. So it disgusted him. It disgusted him all the time, and he would just get upset about it. And he just felt like much of what was going on was just a rigged game. It's a totally rigged game that the general person would never be able to get out of.
What did he think? I appreciate that. What did he think about the remote viewing program?
He believed in it very much. In fact, I introduced him to a number of people behind the scenes related to Dr. Andrei Puharich that he was investigating. He was going to be doing the most significant remote viewer in the world right now, who's not a very public figure and doesn't want to be a public figure. It was Andrei Puharich's other gifted child other than Uri Geller. And Walter Burt was investigating the stuff that was going on at the Monroe Institute, as well as remote viewing in Ingo Swan and that whole group, meme of people that were worked with Stargate. He was very much interested in that, and he was actually going to write a book about this particular woman that had special capabilities and 100% brain sight to see, to remote view naturally, 24 hours a day, nonstop. It wasn't some altered state that she was getting into. It was a contactee case that her brain had been altered, and to this day she can see stuff that telescopes can't even see. So he was in exchange and having conversations with this woman back east to do a special book regarding the properties of remote viewing. So he was very much a believer in it and knew that type of ability existed within all people. And he was trying to facilitate it and promote it, actually, on some levels, because he was always trying to, you know, he wanted to take any normal person and advance their capabilities. He wanted to do the opposite of what the bad guys are doing. He wanted to take a normal person, an athlete, a student, a musician or something, and turn them into something better, but in a really an advanced way. He was very much into seeing what technology could happen, what technology could do for the learning process in terms of getting to people speak multiple languages, getting them to be able to remote view, getting them to be able to alter their states and brain states, to go into trances. He was very much into the applications of hypnosis and what the model of hypnosis in the psychiatric community have got a grip on. That was another major portion of his life, was the understanding of the psychiatric community, the people that model consciousness and what is right and what is wrong, the DSM-4 and the DSM-5 that's coming out. He looked at those, and I don't think people have any understanding how much power the psychiatric community has. It's tied in with the drug companies and everything else on how they literally can harness and take hostage and harvest humans through the psychiatric community. He knows it. I know it. A lot of other people know it. You know, just the mere suggestion that something's the matter with you will put you on drugs. Just watching TV, every other commercial is a drug commercial for something. You got this wrong. You got that wrong. You know, it's not about feeling good. It's about feeling like crap, and then getting yourself installed into a situation where you end up in the psychiatric community, which has completely been infiltrated by the intelligence agencies, and you actually take hostage a country. This country is ill. It's ill. Desensitized, disassociated, lost generation, this country, the United States.
In the notes to the synopsis which I was referring to, The Invisible Third World War, he had some good things to say about L. Ron Hubbard. And I've always wondered whether he had any brushes, positive or negative, with Scientology in any form.
He was worshipped by the Scientologists, actually. In the last couple of years of his life, he was invited to a big VIP party over there. They thought he was a great guy, and he had a great rapport with them. But he liked some of the technology that they have and knew it was good, but he couldn't stand the establishment. He did not like Scientology at all, that type of force that it has, the establishment of it. He did not like. He was asked to be a Scientologist over and over again. He totally refused to be part of it. But he knew the E-meter and some of the technology that they have was actually pretty good. He was a believer in the E-meter, who was not a believer in Scientology as a group.
That's the Church of Scientology, like the formal establishment to me. Yeah,
that's right.
Absolutely understand. Yeah. I had a very strong sense that he had that sense of rapport, but was distancing himself from the Church. That's what I would have expected of him. And it's very interesting that you're confirming that. Thank you very much. I got it.
Was he aware of the connection with the Third Reich and with the Paperclip group?
Oh, yeah. He told me all about it. He said, look, all these guys are brought in, Operation Paperclip. The first time I ever heard about it was from him. And he told me how that occurred, and that science and the whole NASA space outfit is just a big front cover story, and he knew the whole thing was fake. He was well aware of it. I mean, when I first met him, a lot of this stuff was completely new to me, and I was started from scratch. But because at that time, you know, I was aware of the UFO situation, I was aware of the special psychic capabilities of people, and I was immersed into it deeply, which is what brought me in front of him in the first place. He was very much into the UFO thing. Big time, but he was just very quiet about it. From when I met him, it was like the final chapter of his life. So he'd settled down, he'd slow down, he just wanted to write. He wasn't really interested in doing any public venues per se, even though he's asked to all the time. He was kind of burned out on the subject itself, talking about it, and he really wanted to be immersed in the healing aspect of it.
I imagine, James, that he must have built a good rapport with some of the better-known UFO researchers who must have been very sympathetic to his work and his interest.
Yeah, he respected, not that he's a UFO researcher per se, Thomas Bearden. He spoke to him quite a bit, as did I. I have not spoken to him for a long time, but he really respected him. He had always, I would say, he'd always wonder about the motivations of people that would be involved in that field, however they were. So he knew that the whole area was unknown territory for a lot of people, and he thought it would be detrimental to him by hanging around in that environment, because he would bring another piece in at the puzzle, and that he would be interested in those things, but he would be merely acting more of an observer. He always was off in the distance with the UFO stuff, because he had enough problems dealing just with the meme that he created, that he didn't want to be coming out in the UFO field and really speaking up that much, even though it was a huge area of interest for him. I think he refrained from doing that because of, like you said, punishment. My affiliation with Walter Boert opened quite a number of doors because I was actually contracted to be the publicist for James Gilliland. Walter actually met him and liked him quite a bit, actually. And later on, and actually this happened in the last couple of years, after his movie came out, James and the producer asked me to do publicity on it because of my access in Hollywood right now, since I've dealt with a lot of Hollywood upper levels here. So I've always been a firm believer in what is actually happening, though I've not been public about it with my family. I don't talk about it with my friends. I don't see the point, because I do realize one thing after being through all of this with Walter and so forth, that I was always had real issues with secrecy, but I understand why it's been covered up. I totally understand why it's been covered up. It's just people cannot handle a lot. You know, dealing with an advanced species face-to-face, the ramifications of that to the psyche is major. And a lot of people just can't handle it. And I knew in the beginning that, you know, a lot of people that have gone through major cases like Travis Walton, things of a violent nature, things of an unusual nature, people just can't handle it. So I talked to Walter about this, and that's why I don't really discuss it with anybody unless they've been there themselves. I wasn't spending a lot of time, you know, at all these conferences and going to this place. I was kind of quietly investigating it myself and what it meant to the human condition, which is all of you are, you're right in the middle of it. You're unveiling it in a certain sense right now.
It's a big team effort is what I would like to say. And if Walter was here now, I would want to shake his hand and thank him for the fact that he made his journey before us, has made our journey much easier, and that for many other people too. He was a pioneer.
Well, I know that I would say to you, I knew him well enough, that he would be very, very, very grateful that you said that.
Absolutely. It's very true. But what I was actually asking you was whether or not you feel you yourself, during those 10 years and maybe even now, have been subject to, let's say, surveillance.
Everything's under surveillance, all the time, 24/7. And under digital conditions, you can't have privacy and you can't have ownership. So I know that they can tell the temperature of my foot in this room, and they can take this conversation, they can do whatever they want with it. I know that we'll loop out in the digital environment after this is released. I'm well aware of that everything is can be watched from everywhere under satellite conditions. So in some ways, I embrace all of this. I want their surveillance. I want them to hear what I'm saying. I'm not hiding from anybody. I'm not. And nobody else can either.
We actually operate with that same premise because we know we're highly surveilled. But at the same time, it works both ways. In other words, mm-hmm. if they watch us, they have to learn from us. They have no choice on a certain level. It could right. pervade. And the other thing is simply that, as you say, we have nothing to hide. And right. there are more of us all the time, you know, joining the struggle, if you will.
Yeah, I'm for let's let it all hang out. Let's the dirt, the good, the bad, the ugly. Let's open up all the veils. Let's remove the facades in media. Let's get to the root of what's really going on. It's time to do that. So I don't mind them doing all their surveillance, but I think, you know, we should be able to do it on them, and that's essentially why I'm in support of what you guys do. Here's the thing is. You guys, I've watched very closely for the last while what you guys have done, and these people coming forward, and, you know, some of them are big in stature, and they're attracting other people, and I know a lot of people will hold this, and they will look at the website, and I endorse that. I think that some of the people that are in positions have a lot of courage and bravery, and it's a noble thing to be able to come and confess right now. It's a noble thing. It's a fashionable thing. It's the good thing. It's the right thing. So if I can help out in any way to contribute to that, I'll do it. I'm just happy to be doing it through the financial world because there's many people that you've had on that much more in the close-knit than I will ever be. But I'm just doing my part like you guys.
You've done a fabulous job, James, of representing Walter here. And if he was listening, and I've got a feeling that he is, and I mean that quite seriously, I think he would be very proud and grateful for you for your representing him so well. And an enormous number of people are going to be fascinated by how you have helped to tie this all up for them today. And one of those people is myself.
I can tell you I have a strange intuitive psychic connection to him. I always did. And we planned on communicating when he passed. And I've had proof of that from people that I work with that happened post after that. And I know that he's been a part of what I've been doing on radio, which I think it's a small fraction of the bigger picture because I deal with most of the financial stuff that's going on with money and how people are manipulated through that.
James, there's no reason why we can't go down that road rather briefly, but it's important because the financial issues are coming to the fore at this time. And It would be interesting to hear a little more of some of Walter's work, and this would obviously dovetail with your own, in terms of revealing the psychology behind the people who have brought the system to this level and what they're planning and why.
Okay. They do want to create this whole world government thing. However, he knows as well as I know that it's going to fail because cold fusion's been secretly released in China. He knows as well as I do, and other people out there that are listening to me know that technology dictates modality. And with the beginning of these technologies, it's going to alter how we exchange money. Free energy is fully available. He and I talked about what technology was going to do to the human condition, and it's already happening now. I mean, I know a lot of your listeners have said these technologies exist. Well, some of them actually have been put out there. But one of the things that the successful things I've done, and it's been through Walter's efforts, is being able to reveal how the credit card companies use media and the media extension of a kinesthetic thing that you hold in your hand as a way to hijack, harness, and harvest humans, hijack them, make a human being work for a bank willingly over and over and over again, like smoking cigarettes. One of the things that I discovered after studying with him and learning was how this was being done, and I actually verified it after he died because I went and visited with Mary McLuhan, Marshall McLuhan's daughter. I'm on the board of advisors of the Marshall McLuhan Institute on Global Communications because I discovered and told her, you know, I explained to her how I came to her in the first place and that I was working with Boehr, and I discovered what the credit card companies were doing, how they were doing it, and how to get out of it. And more importantly, changing the internal environment of a person that was involved in this huge financial mess, especially with credit cards. Because I was doing this secretly behind the scenes with him while he was alive. It was a very slow process because I initially started fighting credit card companies because I knew that it was completely corrupt. But more importantly, I was fighting the behavior around it of the individuals that was participating in it, the victim of it, the person that would come to me with $80,000 and their entire life had been hijacked and they didn't even know that the money didn't even exist in the first place, and they were basically going through a hypnotic induction of trance after they signed something they didn't even understand, ended up working for the bank for a good portion of their life. To me, that's a total assault on the human spirit, is to hijack them and you end up working for them, and the conditions are set upon where you can use human beings as vehicles for international bankers which do all this crap to people. That is my I came out of the birth canal in my experience with him to deal with that. And I went to Mary McLuhan, who was I drove to her, flew out there, sat down with her, and said, this is what I've done. This is, I've been doing this for the past 10 years. I used to work with Walter Bowert. I said, look, the credit cards are media extensions. They're part of the electrical environment. They are designed to create more debt, hijack the human being, and make an individual work for the bank for potentially the rest of their life, because we knew mathematically that nobody could ever pay these cards off after $6,000 or so, and how that was done. And I was started this very small thing, and I was actually spying on a company that was doing this behind the scenes, some of which you know who these people are. I'm not going to say who they are because I prefer not to, but I was involved with a company that was doing this with against credit card companies. And I was studying, I was reporting back to Walter my findings, and I was deciding, okay, how would we fix this on a large, grandiose level? Where we could tell people, okay, this is what's happened to you. This is the power of media. This is the power of contract law. This is what the bankers have done, and kind of take a person that has been suffering under these conditions of living in massive debt, educating them, and then liberating them and taking them through the necessary tools for the courts or whatever it is to get them out of it. So I told Mary McLuhan this, and I said, your father was right. He was right. As soon as the digital environment came out, it changed the world, especially in banking. And human beings have been harvested, essentially, by the banks with credit card companies. And I told Mary this. I said, Marshall McLuhan was exactly right about the digital environment and what it does to money. You can't have proper accounting under a digital environment. You can hack into anything. There is no proper balance sheets. You've got a bunch of criminals at the very top that are involved with all this UFO stuff as well, involved with all the negative stuff that are going on with the future of what they think we should be doing with the human rights without anybody else being involved. That section I termed with Walter the disease of rich craft. It's the super wealthy that have decided to this is what we're going to do, and we know better than you because we've been controlling the information flow now. But as Marshall McLuhan said, in a post-information environment, there are no secrets. You doing your website and people whistleblowing and all these secrets coming out all over the financial district as well, all the secrets are coming out, which is a great thing. And that is what I decided I would take from Walter forward, because he knew if the money issue was not addressed, and everybody's going to deal with it now, whether they like it or not, if it's not addressed on a global level where we're all participating in it, we're in a lot of trouble.
Did he see that there was an answer to what these rich Illuminati are planning? Did he see an alternative? Did he see, in other words, was the revealing of the secrets, in essence, the answer in his view?
Yes, yes, yes. You can't tell somebody half the story and then control them while they know half the story anymore. You can't do that. Anything that is a secret under digital conditions, according to Marshall McLuhan, which is right, cannot be kept as a secret. So, the National Security Act that Walter said needed to be repealed was a huge portion of his lingo, and as he would talk to people in an interview scenario or whether on TV, how what that did. All the secrecy has just made a mess out of everything. And I know some of the whistleblowers that have spoken on this have talked about secrecy. And thankfully, our tools that humans have created are now going to reveal stuff that's never been revealed before. I mean, all the digital photographs, the video footage, YouTube. I mean, it also creates up other scenarios, too, because now the intelligence agencies use misdirection as a tool to disinform. So counterintelligence is a lot easier than what it used to be, because anything on the Internet is subject to fiction. Everything can be faked. Everything can be faked, but everything can be revealed at the same time. I talk about this on my radio show. It's an unknown landscape that nobody really wants to address. The ramifications of the digital environment on consciousness, secrecy, control, all the stuff that you guys talk about with other people, all of that is not really being discussed. I mean, that's part of the issue I have, and Walter did with the UFO environment, is the lack of education in terms of the training of perception and what that is. He knows as well as I know that, and he knew this because of what had took place in the 60s with his contactee issues, with the use of LSD. He knew that human beings and, you know, the amount of brains that we use now of 3 or 4% or whatever they call it, isn't nearly, it's been kept that way on purpose to make sure people are morons, to make sure they're confused, to make sure they're misdirected, to make sure they don't evolve. He knew that there was a group out there that was keeping everybody in the dark. Now, thankfully, that inevitably through the cosmos is ending now, and we're all going through this. The light bulbs are starting to go off and people are starting to ask better questions, and questions right. And so the questioner have a relationship.
It's a double-edged sword, in essence, this digital environment that you're talking about. You're talking about there is an upside, because the reality is that Project Camelot would not exist if it were not for the internet.
Exactly.
It simply makes what we do possible.
That's right.
So it is fascinating, the mind control and the downside of media for sure, but there is an upside that is equally as strong,
right,
and is coming to the fore at the same time.
That's right.
So, yeah, and obviously it also makes possible what you're doing, which you say you're going on radio, you're revealing the credit card scams and the fact that it is basically creating a slave society to the banks. And all of that is possible, again, through the use of media. We're really talking about a tool, and a tool can be used for good or for evil.
That's right. That's right. And we're at a critical stage right now because the banks betrayed everybody in the stimulus package. It's happened in front of everybody. The whole of society is completely complacent to this. We've got complete, total corruption going on, and people are walking around the streets like nothing's happening because of the discontinuity that the information environment creates. I mean, most people that will be listening to this have already been interrupted by the telephone, the cell phone, or they're surfing the web, so they're not entirely in the conversation to begin with. Nobody is. Everybody's trying to connect to somebody right now. And that's part of the problem. Most people that are driving their cars aren't even driving their cars. They're talking on the phone, texting. We've got all these changes happening now, and people are trying to connect with one another, and it's not occurring, and it's affecting the brain. You know, I just interviewed a psychiatrist that's opened up the first clinic for internet addiction. Now, so basically we have the psychiatric community is going to dictate to you, the public, what it is that's the matter with you because you're on the web all the time, which is inevitable because people are carrying around their devices because information shrinks.
Right.
Because it overlaps on each other.
But if you look at that in another way, the phrase you used is people are trying to connect with each other. And they're trying to do that all the time. There is something going on in terms of the mirror of the internet and the universal mind and the fact that this organism, which is humanity, is one, and it is trying to connect and draw connections, and those nerves are they're trying to jump the synapses or whatever you call it in order to connect, in order to become aware. Awake and aware. I mean, there is the positive side of that. So
yes,
although
right.
It may, unfortunately, what happens with, and this is where I think it gets also taken offline, is where the psychiatrists and so on will suddenly decide that being connected is a disease. And they will start to tell people, oh, it's a problem for you to be on the internet. It's a problem for you to connect with your friends and your family and so on. And
right.
The reason that becomes a problem for them, now that they've established this, now that it's actually taken on a life of its own, is that suddenly if you have connection, you also have awakening. And with awakening, you also can have a resistance movement that will change the face of what they don't want to see happen. So what they want to try to do, I think, is reverse the trend in essence, call it a disease. On the other hand, what it might really be is the expansion of the brain. What it might really be is us starting to communicate on so many levels very rapidly that the synapses are being jumped. And in essence, what they want to start to do is isolate the individuals from each other, so that they're more isolated, so countries aren't in contact with each other. and people aren't in contact with their families in other places, and so on and so forth. And the isolation will also breed a better slave society.
Exactly. You're exactly right. That's the effects that are occurring right now. I mean,
like
I live in Los
circle.
Angeles, and I'm witnessing it.
It's a fascinating syndrome, and apparently Walter himself was at the absolute center of this sort of storm that started back then in the 60s and is actually having some very important ramifications and sort of a shift from negative even to positive with a lot of these things. In other words, if he'd lived long enough, he might have actually realized or been able to see the fruits of his labor.
Yes. He always told me he was going to live to 84, and he was very much a spiritual, shamanistic type of personality that was trying to not only heal himself, but stick around for where we're at now, because he knew it was coming. Obviously, he decided to depart beforehand, but he knows this is the most important time probably for the human race is going on now. And he had his whole thing about 2012, and as I do. And
do you want to talk about that at all?
Yeah, I will tell you that prior to Walter's death, we were discussing these matters with the curanderos in Peru, with the shamans there. So I've been participating and have strong relationships and still do with the curanderos of Peru, have surprisingly an incredible understanding of what's going on the planet in terms of what's going to be coming. And they're well aware that the human beings, some are being prepared for this transformation. So what I did is I discussed this with Walter because this is a big life decision, and he wished he could have done this, and he was jealous that I got to do it and he didn't. I went and participated with ayahuasca, and I got to see. It opened the brain up further. I got to see coming attractions, what mistakes I've made, my effects on my choices and all those things in life. And it was from ayahuasca, actually, that I got a much, much larger picture of the coming situation. I've participated with ayahuasca and Wachuma at the sacred temples under the tutelage of a very long-standing shaman there. Now, Walter heavily endorsed this as a tool not only for transformation but for healing, and it's all over the internet, and I know a lot of big-name producers and celebrities that have used this as a vehicle to unlearn what they've learned. In other words, change the neural network patterns that have been running their life negatively. And one of the things that I did, which I discussed with Walter prior to doing this, was a media fast, which is essential for anybody that's living in the conditions we're living in. When what I mean by media fast is cutting yourself off from all stimulus, paper, television, computer, time, everything, and going back into nature and letting go of all that and returning back to your original source. And the ayahuasca experience, which Walter wrote about to me in a lot of personal notes and stories, that he said this would be the tool necessary for my life and other people's lives to help them get out of the existing patterns. Because the problem with media is it installs a lot of patterns in there and suggests a lot of stuff that just isn't self-supportive in the human condition at all. And when you take a media fast and you go and do ayahuasca, you do get to see the stuff that you normally would not get to see, including advanced species and including things that are going on inside the physical body that's affecting your own perception, blocks in your ability to see things as they really are. So I took place in all of those things, and currently I'm on the, because of that, I'm on the board of advisors of a television show which is going to be discussing some of these advanced scientific principles that have been held in secret for a TV network that's been created by Emmy Award-winning actor Ian Bailey. It's ImagineThisTV.com. This is the television show which I guarantee you is going to address some of the hidden sciences that have been held back behind the scenes on purpose by the powers that be, and also to do a firmer grasp of humanity, a more thoughtful, provoking humanitarian aid to aid the people that have been victims of the banking world.
Well, thank you for that. But in terms of 2012 and what Walter himself thought it would hold, because we have obviously a ton of interest in this area, it would be also useful to hear your own take.
It's happening right now. It's happening now. The 2012 thing is occurring now. What I saw in ayahuasca, it's deeply related to what's happening now. It's basically human beings are changing. They're getting ready to integrate with advanced species, our ancestors. And a human being is going to be very, very, 50 years from now, will be living under completely different conditions. So we're going through, we're ready to breaking out of the chrysalis of the stuck states that we've been in for a long time. I saw it on ayahuasca, and I know this is a chronological thing having to do with where humans are at in their evolution, what's happening with other planets, the extraterrestrial relationship that we've had. All of that is playing a part, and I think, and I don't think that it's a specific date something is going to happen.
Yes, we would agree with you on that. What we have is a span of years, and indeed we would agree also that we're going through it now. But is there anything specific, for example, that Walter himself, either through the whistleblowers that basically were coming to him, because he was talking to people in Black Projects, they must have been telling him also about the building of the underground bases, et cetera, et cetera. Was there anything he told you about that?
Yeah, he had gotten calls, some of these type of people, but he could never really do as much as he wanted with it because he didn't know if it was he was being set up or not. So he took the information, took these phone calls, did these interviews, but he didn't actually do anything with a lot of it because it may be dangerous. Because he was punished, and he didn't forget that. And so he didn't take a lot of action. But he I'm not
so
saying
So in other words, you do not have information specifically that they revealed what they saw or what they were planning for coming down the line in the next few years.
Yeah, he was very simple, the integration of an advanced species. That's
okay.
It.
So that's it in general terms.
It's the kahunas of the whole thing. It has to do with the amnesia is going to be removed of who we are as a species. That's what it is. It's the only thing it is.
Okay.
It's our ancestry. All the little things beneath it, I mean, the ramifications of the President of the United States coming out and saying this, we are not alone, even though it's all over the place. And my opinion is if he did that, people would go, okay, that's great. What time does the football game start? People are just not going to react in the way that they've been worried about because we're so conditioned now. I mean, this alien archetype is everywhere from, it's on candy wrappers, it's in movie theaters, it's all over the TV, it's all over the internet, it's part of fashion culture, it's everywhere. It's the amount of movies that Hollywood has churned out on this subject matter, I think people are going to be ready. And plus, if he does come out and make an announcement, which I'm totally in for, I hope this happens very quickly. It's about time that this will trigger something better for all of us. But Walter and I both knew that the larger missing link is the removal of the amnesia of the human condition to realize that we're part of something much, much bigger and that we do have a destiny. We are supposed to be going back to the stars, so to speak.
Well, that's a wonderful thing to close.
It's a wonderful thing to close. It echoes what Bob Dean says, one of the people who we love greatest among all of our witnesses, and he says our destiny is in the stars, and he prefaces that by saying that we're not alone, we never have been alone, and we only are looking through human history, past and future, through the tiniest keyhole at the moment, and it's making that hole larger and stepping through it. It seems to me that this is what Walter was committed to and what his purpose was and what his journey was all about.
He and I both agreed and formed a brothership based on this. This is about the liberation of the human spirit, period.
That's a beautiful way to summarize this whole complex edifice that we've been discussing.
Oh, absolutely. I thank you for doing this, for Walter, for myself, and hopefully this will add another layer in there that will allow people to relax and realize that if they've heard this and they've been paying attention, they're part of the solution.
That's great.
That's beautiful. This has been a very strong interview, and I've been really delighted, and thank you so much for making yourself available and for responding intuitively as you did. You've been very eloquent. The information has been of the highest quality, and I think Walter would be absolutely delighted, so thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it. I will be in touch.
Okay. Take care.
Take care now. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.